We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime. Well,
thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is our podcast of the Election Integrity Network, sponsored by the Conservative Partnership Institute. And I'm the chairman of the Election Integrity Network and the senior legal fellow at the Conservative Partnership Institute. Here is where we talk about all things related to elections, how elections are supposed to run, how sometimes they don't run the way they're supposed to, and what we as citizens can do to make sure that our elections are conducted in accordance with the rule of law. That's all we're interested in, making sure that we're following the law. And today we have a very special guest who's been a friend of mine for more than a decade, and that is the Secretary of State of Louisiana, the Honorable Kyle Ardoin, who also happens to be the national president of the National Association of Secretaries of State, NASS. And so, Mr. Secretary Kyle, welcome to Who's Counting.
Thanks, Cleta. Great to be with a good friend and talk about the issues facing our country.
Well, Kyle, you have been, it's okay if I call you Kyle, right? I don't want to be disrespectful because you are very prominent.
No. You know, there's no pretentiousness here with me.
I know. That's one of the reasons that you're so wonderful. But let's start by, and thank you so much for spending some time with us. We really appreciate it. Tell me a little bit, tell everybody a little bit about your background. You're a native of Louisiana. You're the 44th Secretary of State. So talk about your path to becoming the Secretary of State. I know I first met you when you were the top deputy Secretary of State, but talk about how you got into this business in the first place.
Oh my, I've always had a desire to be involved in the political arena. As far back as I can remember, I was interested in the Ford re-election when I was in second grade. No, that was fourth grade. That was fourth grade. So it goes that far back. And my parents just thought I was some sort of alien because they were not involved in politics. I had a great uncle that was involved in politics on the state level, but he was thwarted because he was conservative. And of course, you know, Louisiana was dramatically different back then, heavy Democrat. Conservative type Democrats, but populist more, I guess. I got really involved in the re-election campaign of Governor Dave Treen, the first Republican governor since Reconstruction. Edwin Edwards, and of course he got beat pretty bad. I was probably the only person that thought we could win re-election. I met a lot of people during that campaign. I became a page in the state House of Representatives under the Edwards administration, sponsored by one of the, I think, 10 Republicans in the House at that time. And now we have 68 Republicans in the House out of 105 members. And we're really proud of that. And dramatically different legislature. The Senate is now 2/3 Republican supermajority. So we're excited about that.
That is good, because particularly when you have a Democrat for a governor.
Right. And so I got involved that way. I worked my way up, ended up working as a deputy clerk of the House, and then graduated from LSU in poli-sci, went into lobbying, and created my own lobbying firm and association management firm. And that's how I got to meet my predecessor, because he was chair of the Health and Welfare Committee for 4 years. And so I got to know him because I had a lot of healthcare clients at the time. And
that was Tom Shedler.
Correct. Tom Shedler. He was a state senator for 12 years, and he worked closely with Jay Darden, who became Secretary of State during their final term together. And so he brought Secretary Darden brought on Tom to be his first assistant, which is the chief deputy. And so when then Secretary of State Darden ran for lieutenant governor and won in a special election, Tom automatically ascended to the position and had to run for it. And I texted him once he became secretary and I said, hey, you need a first assistant. I was just kind of joking because I was running a trade association at the time. And he said, come visit with me. And so the rest is history. And here I am sitting in a position I never thought I would sit in. The good Lord convinced me to run for the position when I had initially said I would not, trying to keep the agency afloat and dealing with the aftermath of some of the issues that Tom had to resign over. But anyway, we did it. We won. We beat 8 people in the first round, wow. A Democrat in the second round, and then I had to turn around and run the next year and won a full 4-year term. So my year, let's see, next year is re-election year, so we're gearing up for that, and just came back from Shreveport, North Louisiana for a 2-day tour and had a fundraiser up there and did well. And so talking to citizens all around the state about the condition of elections and where we're headed with our election system, our voting system, and really excited about the opportunities that we have as Louisiana as a leader in the nation. As you know, Heritage ranks us 7th in the nation in election integrity, and I feel wonderful about that. Mm-hmm. And finally, Louisiana's on a list, top of the list on something good. We're used to being on the bottom of lists that are good. So anyway, we're excited about that, and people are really responding to our message.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is so impressive, and a reason why I think that that you would be ranked at the top, of course, you know, that's a reflection of the election laws. It ranks the election codes, and you've been very instrumental in going to the legislature and getting things that are problematic fixed. But the other thing that I want to say to everybody that is that I really admire about you is that you really have such an open attitude and a listening ear. When the citizens complain or express concerns to you, you don't just stiff arm them. I mean, I can think of several things that you've done that to me shows that you're a really good listening public servant. And like, for instance, and we'll talk about some of these things in more detail, but I just think that you set a really good example for other secretaries of state in terms of transparency and accountability. And talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you and your office have faced with the weather, holding elections in hurricane season, the battles that you had to fight. Talk about the battles you had to fight when the Democrats were trying to force Louisiana to go to massive mail voting, and you were able to stop that in 2020. Talk a little bit about the fights that you had then and how you prevailed.
Yeah, so we were under threats by liberal organizations to sue us, and they did end up suing us, wanting us to mail out either absentee ballot requests or mail out ballots just in general. They wanted us to expand early voting. They wanted us to expand voting hours, and if you will, and just about anything that they could figure out to challenge us on that they've not been able to get passed through the legislature. There are provisions in the law in Louisiana to allow us to address emergencies, whether it's changing the date of qualifying or changing the dates of the elections if it's not a federal election. And going into the presidential, obviously you can't change the date of the federal presidential election. And so what we did is we developed an emergency plan. We decided to develop a what we call a COVID absentee ballot request form. And that expanded to about 5 additional reasons. We already have 9 reasons to request an absentee ballot. And so we had some trouble with that at the beginning, but we were able to push it through. Myself and the Attorney General push it through the legislature. The conservatives were balking, but it turned out to be the best backup plan, if you will, backstop to what the liberal groups were trying to force down our throats. And because we were able to pass that plan, when they did sue, a very surprisingly, a liberal Obama appointee judge in the on the federal bench said that the government did all that they could to provide for the opportunity for individuals who feared COVID or were affected by COVID or had COVID, whatever, were able to vote. And it was that very thing. When she agreed with us, I about fell out of my chair. I was just totally surprised. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we kept from having to do things differently in Louisiana. We kept our processes in place that prove the integrity of the election. And we weren't just blanket pushing out ballots to people that we were concerned would A, not get it, or B, be intercepted by liberal organizations trying to manipulate the election.
In Louisiana, you have to meet certain criteria or be qualified to cast an absentee ballot by virtue of some statutory provisions. Third party groups can't just send out blanket absentee ballot applications in Louisiana.
No, you have to request an absentee ballot. You using a form that we create, and you have to qualify for it. The local registrar receives that request, mm-hmm. and then you've got to identify yourself. You got to provide personal identifying information, and you've got to attest to it under penalty of law. And then the registrars check those out. And if it's a valid voter, then they send the ballot to them. And we are experiencing in that a lot because of natural disasters like hurricanes. You know, mm-hmm. 2020 was the worst, 2021, almost as bad. But bottom line is because we're experiencing that, we already know the process to deal with it. And really that's what has trained us to be able to not have to expand it. And I'll say this, Kalita, for all the machination that went on in the courtrooms and in the press about, oh, we're going to disenfranchise people. We're going to blah, blah, blah. We're cutting off people's, we're putting people's health at risk, et cetera, et cetera. In the presidential election itself, just over 5,000 people took advantage of that request form alone. And the presidential preference primary is only slightly over 1,500. So the bottom line is, for all the hullabaloo that was out there, it didn't mean anything. People still went and voted. 93% of 2.1 million voters went and voted in person during the height of COVID.
I think it proves that the plan that you put together was a valid plan. And I know that there were some conservatives who were concerned because you added three or four additional criteria to be able to qualify for an absentee ballot because of COVID. But I thought that it was really smart because you anticipated what the left was going to do and you basically prepared for it. And then, as you said, the Obama judge ruled in your favor, which nobody expected. So you did. That shows you were smart thinking ahead.
Yeah, what we knew we needed a backstop, and we knew we needed to have done a little bit of something, but just blindly abandoning the processes that we've perfected over the years made no sense whatsoever, and would have opened us up, I think, to a lot more shenanigans like we saw in other states.
Well, you really did a great job with that, and you testified recently before the U.S. Senate Rules Committee. And I just wanted to mention some of the things you testified about, because I think that you really hit on some really good points. And one of them was this idea of voting in person. And you talked about the problems that many states are learning about, which is a paper shortage. I've heard book publishers talking about the paper shortage. I mean, I guess we have shortages of everything in America under this administration. I don't know. We didn't have shortages when Donald Trump was president, but now we have all these shortages. I wonder if there's a correlation. Well, that's a different topic. But talk about this issue of the paper shortages that you testified about, and what steps you've taken, and what's going on. I'll bet a lot of our audience don't know about this paper shortage that could impact elections this year.
Well, it's really starting to come to root. People are starting to wake up to the issue. The industry's been warning us since the beginning of the year about the issue. And my staff came to me, actually our printer came to me and we met on the situation, and he felt like that he could meet the needs, and he already had allocations promised to him. But then we realized, well, we went to bid on the absentee ballot envelope process printing, and we only had one bidder, and then when they came back, they realized before accepting the bid, the award of the contract, they said, "We're sorry, we've just found out we're not going to be able to meet your timeline." And we're like,
"Oh my."
So we went into emergency mode, and we got with our Division of Administration, which is sort of the state agency that is management of state contracts and everything mm-hmm. like that, day-to-day operations. And we got with them, and they put a person on it, and they started calling every paper mill in North America.
Wow.
We found one that would give us the smaller supply that we need to be able to get the ballots done. And so we're in that process already. Well, that raised my antenna. So I met with industry folks, and they told me, yeah, they'd been warning about it. They were concerned about it. I actually even had testimony before our voting system commission about the paper shortage. And it wasn't until we experienced it that it would realize it. And now I'm warning people, you know, we could be in peril with this election if the president doesn't do something. I mean, he initiated the Defense Production Act for solar, but
oh my gosh,
not engaged the Defense Production Act for paper, for voting, for ballots. And it's like, you know,
what's that all about?
Yeah, where are you? Why are you not responding to this? And I was asked by a reporter for, CNBC, and they said, has the president responded to you all, your request? And I said, well, what have you heard? And I've said, nothing.
Nothing? And how long has that been since you first raised that issue?
Oh, it's been a couple of months.
Oh, my gosh.
Letters to Congress and everything, and the White House, and nothing. Nothing. Congress has reacted. I will say that's why I think I was invited to testify before the Senate Rules Committee. But Senators Klobuchar and Blunt have reacted, and they've contacted the EAC and asked what they were doing about it, and were they raising the alarm? And so it's out there. And there was a news article that just came out. Route 50 just put out an article about our testimony before committee and the paper shortage, had the interview with CNBC. And then I understand that the Bipartisan Institute was having a panel yesterday or earlier this week about the paper shortage. The warning that I got from the industry folks is that the smaller jurisdictions, so Louisiana is a top-down state, so my office handles it for all 64 parishes. In other states, they're handled on the county level, and if they are ordering small batches, they're probably thinking, well, I don't have a problem. And the reality is, you will have a problem if you have not already engaged your printers, or if your vendors haven't engaged you on your supply needs, because it's not just the ballots, but it's the envelopes, it's the instructions, it's everything surrounding elections. And so it's a serious issue, in my opinion. And if states or local jurisdictions haven't woken up to this fact, they're gonna have a real issue, because not only is there a shortage of the paper, the time frame to get your supply has now expanded. And so extension, you know, we have federal deadlines we have to meet. We have the 45-day military and overseas ballots we have to meet. And we usually print all of our ballots as soon as we have closed qualifying, we start that process. So qualifying is mid-July for us. And so as soon as that happens, you know, we don't have much time in between to play with.
Well, Do you have a sense, has NAS done any kind of a survey of the states to try to determine whether the different states are on top of this? I mean, is that something that the staff is working on?
We haven't done a survey. We have put information out to all of the secretaries to update their local jurisdictions. We're having the American Paper and Forestry Association, I think is their name. They're going to be on one of our weekly calls to address the situation and inform us of their position and what they're trying to do to assist in this process. They are communicating with their members. They understand where things are. They did give us a very, gave me a very good explanation as to the issues that they've been facing, because they're also, like everybody else, which I really just don't understand, Cleta, for the life of me. We had a full moving economy before COVID with probably the least amount of unemployment ever.
In our history, modern history.
And now we have businesses that can't find workers. It's like we went from almost full employment to where are the workers? It's
like, where have they gone? I don't know. I really don't know where they've gone.
I don't know. It's like people vanished in thin air. And as far as I know, the rapture has not occurred yet. And
so, well, if it has, I didn't get raptured. So I'm really kind of worried about that.
I better run to confession real quick. But it's just beyond me. And then I passed local McDonald's the other day, and they had a huge banner hanging. We pay $10 an hour. You know, please, why? And I'm going, I never even dreamed I would make it. And I worked in the House of Representatives at the age of 20 plus during college. I was excited to get $5.50 an hour.
Well, my high rate, but this tells you how old I am. When I was babysitting 60 hours a week, I got paid $12.50 a week. So
a week,
but that was a long time ago. But well, I know, I'm wondering, is there anything that you think would be useful for citizens to do? Maybe even just to talk to their local election offices and find out, hey, have you ordered your paper? Are you aware of the impending, or even just talk to state election boards? I don't know. We probably ought to put that on the agenda for people just to ask, just citizens asking.
Yeah, citizens need to engage. I think they need to engage their members of Congress because I don't think there's enough of an urgency. I have spoken to members of Congress and members of the U.S. Senate, high ranking, that understand that there could be an issue, but I'm pretty sure everybody's kind of frozen and not sure
what to do.
Where the problem could be, and if it hits too late, then we're back in a chaotic election situation, and that's not where the country needs to be right now, unless
that's what they intend.
Yeah. And I was asked yesterday on a radio program yesterday morning that do you foresee issues being conjured up that could create issues for our elections? And, one popped into my mind, of course, monkeypox. And I've read articles about it, and I've read articles where physicians are saying, no, you've got to have some really close contact with people if they have it. And it's very rare, and it's treatable very fast. And yet the CDC has already come out with mask mandates because of monkeypox. We're headed in the wrong direction.
Yeah. I did read that they put it up and then they took it down a few hours later. So who knows what they're rules are. They don't know. No. They have no idea.
We provided it, but to have 93% of our people vote in person, people want to make sure their vote counts. And that's what I promote. In person is better than anything else if you want to make sure your vote counted, because you can't depend upon the postal service.
No.
You can't.
One of the things that we heard all over the country in 2020, and I don't know if you heard this, but we heard it in Georgia after the election. Then I learned that other states heard it too. But people saying that when they get to the polls, they were told, oh, we show you've already voted. I had never heard that before. And it was very widespread. I'll bet you didn't have that in Louisiana. Did you hear any of that in Louisiana?
No. So our Our early voting system is a week prior to the election, actually 2 weeks prior to the election, 7 days of early voting, 14 days prior to the election. So we have a week in between.
Oh, that's good. So you can get everything ready.
That's exactly right. So we can make sure that we have updated all of our lists for those who voted in person early. And then we have a cutoff time frame of absentee ballots by 4:30 p.m. the day before the election. So we are then able to create supplemental lists overnight, and those get delivered to each precinct in each parish by sheriff's deputies. And that way the polling commissioners can update their list right there if someone shows up. But I think we had one report of an elderly parent who forgot that they early voted.
Oh, and right.
They had the exact same name, obviously, as the son. And the son showed up to vote, and the dad had voted in his place. And the son said, well, we voted the same way anyway, and I don't want to press charges. And, you know, he suffers from dementia. And so, you know, that's totally understandable. And you know, you don't want to chase down elderly people and arrest them.
Well, that's an isolated instance that you can actually identify. And it's the thing that we can never figure out. I've never been able to figure out.
And the good news is we were able to identify what it was.
That's right.
We figured it out. And so what we could have done is cancel the early vote. We do have a process where we could cancel the early vote if someone voted on election day. We can do it. And so we have security measures in place, and our early voting is real time. So when you check in at the early voting station in your parish, the whole system statewide knows that person has checked in, so they can't vote anywhere else.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Well, one of the other things you talked about in your testimony, and I want you to talk about what are MSPs? And talk to people about what you raised with the Senate Rules Committee and MSPs as it relates to elections.
So MSPs are referred to as managed service providers. So these are, in most cases, small businesses that help other small businesses manage their IT systems. And they're efficient because they mow them into your IT system. They have direct access and they manage it that way. The problem is that they are targets of China and Russian operatives and even some domestic operatives to install malware and ransomware on their systems. So what China figured out some years ago, and the FBI had reported to me, was that some local governments, even entities, were using these MSPs, and they were actually targeted through the MSP and ransomed. And luckily, our system is separate. Our entire election system is separate from our local administrators, or controlled by us and not them, so they don't need these services. So the FBI had called me and said, do you have a list of these folks so that we can contact them to see, one, if they've been targeted, two, if they've been successfully attacked, and three, to be able to contact their clients. And I said, well, no, interestingly enough, I didn't even know what MSPs were. And so I decided, well, we had a number of local governments like school boards and some sheriff's offices and some clerks of court were compromised in these attacks. And so I decided I'm going to lead the way. I'm going to create, in a conservative way, I'm going to lead the way. I don't want to create a regulatory environment. I think they need to regulate themselves. If you want to stay in business, you've got to really do the job that you're saying you're doing. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that some of these MSPs weren't being truthful with their clients in the true cost of protecting them. And so they weren't keeping up the protective environment because they didn't want to lose business because the expense is growing exponentially each year. as is the liability issue for losing information or having to pay ransomware. So we said, all we want to do is create a registry of the MSPs so that local governments know who they are. And we want you to have to report any attacks, successful attacks, and if you pay out any ransomware.
Oh, wow.
And so they worked really well with us. We were able to get it done. Some of the bigger companies were pushing back, but we finally were able to get it through several years ago. And so we do have a registry. And now we've protected that registry from public records requests, because then we realized, well, we put a bullseye on them. Why? So the nefarious actors could just ask for a public records request and go after each one of them. So we protected them as well. And so we feel good about that. And we feel like we're leading the way because, you know, obviously China and Russia and Russian operatives and oligarchs and you name it aren't going to stop until they, you know, tear down our republic from the inside out and using our own people to do it nefariously. And so we just wanted to raise the awareness of the issue. I did so at NAS. I got a lot of coverage inside the techie world in terms of articles for IT professionals. And the International Association has contacted me and been working with me on numerous occasions because it's the first in the world that we've done this. And so they wanted to make sure we were doing it the right way. And I just told them, I said, y'all need to create a certification process and then y'all need to promote that so that customers know which level of certification and protection that they're getting when they sign
up. That's a great idea. That's a great idea. And so this was really separate from the election space. Because this had to do with state government as a whole of state government and all the businesses that do business with state government, I guess.
Yes, and local government.
Which leads me to this issue that I know that you've been particularly keen on, and that is the question that a lot of citizens have raised about the vulnerability of voting machines. And I'm somebody who... You know, I always say I can barely work my iPhone. So, you know, any of this technology, you start talking technology and you'll lose me pretty quickly. But there are people who've really done a lot of work over the years in the IT field, in software and all, and who have engineers, people who work for NASA, and that I've talked to, and they say there are these vulnerabilities in voting machines. And I honestly... you know, somewhere from the Kraken to the, you know, there's some truth somewhere. What have you experienced? And I know that you've asked some questions of some vendors of voting machines to try to get some answers about some things. Talk to me and to us about what your thoughts are. You've clearly been a pioneer in working in the area of protecting security of information systems and computers and all and technology. Talk to us and tell us what you've learned and what you think about the vulnerabilities of voting machines. What are the kinds of steps that citizens can take to make sure that their local or state election offices are actually being transparent and telling them the truth about what they're doing? I don't know. I mean, it just seems like there's a lot of suspicion out there. And I always figure the best way to eliminate suspicion is for sunshine and transparency. But you're a leader in this. What do you say to citizens who say, I'm really worried about voting on a voting machine?
I tell them I don't blame you. But at the same time, I tell them, at least in Louisiana, because we don't have a paper trail yet, we're working towards that. Because we have to be able to allow voters to verify their vote first and foremost before they cast it, and then we want to be able to audit the results to make sure that the election was reported accurately and that the equipment was working properly. There is a lot of fear mongering out there.
I think so too.
But I will say this, name me a single IT system that doesn't have some vulnerability anywhere in it in any industry.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, You know, I like to take Ronald Reagan's quote, I'll trust, but I'll verify. And we need to be able to verify. And I'm pushing the industry to be more transparent. Right now, it's like they're in lockdown mode. Since the 2020 election, they don't want to share information. You know, I've pushed our vendor because we're a statewide a top-down system. Everybody votes on the same machines during early voting statewide. Everybody votes on the same types of machines on election day. And so I need to give my citizens a level of confidence that their vote is being accurately counted. There is nothing concrete that has shown that any election results have been tampered with yet in Louisiana. But I'm not so naive to think that there aren't vulnerabilities there. CISA just came out with a report, and yes, there's some vulnerabilities with the types of early voting machines that we have that has been shown by Dr. Alex Halderman over in Georgia. But Georgia's machines aren't exactly the same as ours. It's the same prototype, but it's not the same version, okay, if you will. And the software that they're running is not the software that Louisiana runs. Louisiana's is more Louisiana-centric because of our laws and because of our processes. We have a challenge process for inside of our early voting process. Georgia does not. And so it's totally different. But could there be vulnerabilities? Absolutely. Well, are those vulnerabilities able to be tapped in? If someone has total access to each individual machine without ever being discovered, then yes, the vulnerabilities could be exploited. Have they? No. We keep them under lock and key 24/7, 365 days a year. So we have no fear of that. Are there ways that we could document each day or document differently each day and have each parish board of election supervisors certify the results each day? And then on election day, when they're tabulating, they look at all the numbers and recertify everything as that was exactly what happened each day. Perhaps that's a way to additionally document. Those are the types of things that we have to do until we can get to a paper-based process. And I want to get to a paper-based process because I want voters to verify their vote in hand, and then I want them to cast it and then us be able to audit it. We just finished an extensive legislative audit that the legislature called for in our last statewide election. We got a clean bill of health from the legislative auditor and exclusively saying that there was nothing that they could see that causes any concern regarding the integrity of elections in Louisiana.
Well, that's a plus. That's a real feather in your cap.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, but I intend to hopefully work with the vendor and Dr. Halderman and see, okay, what are the possible exploitations and what are all the ways that we're mitigating those possible attacks in place today? Are those good enough, or do we need to beef up in some other way? And how do we do that? And so that's what we're working on now. I tried to intervene in the lawsuit in Georgia so that I could get my hands on Dr. Halderman's report.
Yeah, because it's under seal.
Right. The judge rebuked me. And I was even more ticked off that the Secretary of State themselves opposed us being able to get that report. As a colleague, you know, I thought it was
not the right thing to do. Well, that's the history of Brad Raffensperger in Georgia.
He's trying to protect his state. Well, I'm trying to protect my state. And why shouldn't I get a copy of it? So the judge easily just said, oh, well, go hire Dr. Halderman yourself and have him examine it. Well, I tried to do that already, and the vendor sent me a two-page letter saying no. basically saying no, you can go to an independent laboratory. Well, that brings me to a whole nother thing, which is the independent laboratories are the ones that should have caught these issues in the first place.
Yeah, that's true. And why didn't they? Are they funded by the vendors?
I Yes. So the testing is paid for by the vendors to the testing facilities that are certified by the EAC. And I think that's a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
And how do I know what the vendor submitted was the actual that for testing? That's actually what I got.
Oh, they won't tell you that?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I don't have the information. There's just a lot of questions, and I understand why people are asking them, and I'm really glad citizens are asking them. At first, you know, right after in 2021 the legislative session, I felt like we were under total attack as right. the chief elections officer, as the Department of State, local election officials. I mean, it was coming at us at all angles. And finally, I said, okay, let's dial down this dialogue.
Yeah.
Let's tamper it down and let's really talk. So I started meeting with people who were testifying, who were passionate, who were angry, who were, you know, and I said, look, okay, Trump won in Louisiana. If right. Trump had lost in Louisiana, and I said this one day, I couldn't believe it was coming out of my mouth. And God knows if I was actually a little prophetic at the time. I said, if Trump loses Louisiana, then you darn well bet I'm having a full audit. We're total investigation. We're calling up the National Guard.
Because you knew where the citizens were.
Yeah, because and the irony is Trump got more raw votes mm-hmm. than any Republican president in history in Louisiana yep. that we can recall that we have data on.
And that's true nationwide.
And he increased his raw vote from 2016 to 2020. He increased his raw vote.
And so I
keep trying to tell people, if you believe that there's something going on nefarious outside of our realm, because that's
yeah.
as I discussed Louisiana's processes and procedures, as I opened up our doors, as I opened up dialogues with folks, they realized we're as locked down as we possibly can be. Mm-hmm. Their concern was, what's happening beyond us and our processes? Is there some sort of nefarious yeah. act going on there, which is where I think things are focused on now in terms of some sort of national conspiracy of flipping votes. But as I tell people, I don't certify any results for anybody else other than Louisiana.
That's right. You can't be responsible for anybody else.
That's right.
You can only get guidance. So
that was a long way to answer your question. I hope.
Well, you know, that's good. But, you know, one of the things too, I'm sitting here thinking about some of the things I've heard people say, and you're talking about that you want to have a paper trail. You know, I'm aware because of my work in the post-election in Georgia in 2020. And of course, Georgia has all Dominion machines. And we didn't include anything about the voting machines in the election contest that we filed on behalf of President Trump. We just went to the voter roll records and that they're such a mess. And, you know, more people registered at vacant lots and cast ballots in the election in Georgia than the margin of difference between Joe Biden and President Trump. Now that one, and we had 30 categories like that, which is that one category of illegal votes. It was enough in my, you know, under the Georgia law to have required a new election, but we never got a judge appointed to hear the case. But one of the things that I've learned in that process, talking to someone who's an expert, he used to be a consultant to Dominion, he lives in San Francisco. In San Francisco, of all places, and apparently this is a feature of Dominion machines, but not many jurisdictions buy it. I guess it costs extra. It's a bell and a whistle, I guess. But the digital images of every ballot are published every day in San Francisco. So all the ballots that go through the Dominion machine, it makes a digital image, and then that's a public record, and they're published every day. So you have that digital image. Maybe that's not the paper, but at least you have a digital image, and you can see those every day, which I thought was kind of interesting. But the other thing that I know some people in Georgia are concerned about is that the machines will give you a confirmation copy of your ballot, maybe before you cast it or, you know, whatever, but it has a QR code mm-hmm. on it. Mm-hmm. And that barcode, of course, can't be read by human eye.
Right.
And And there are people who are concerned that that barcode, because it isn't something that is readily discernible to a human, to the voter, that they don't like the barcode on there. So there are things that I don't, like I say, I'm not able to converse intelligently. I'm only able to raise questions. And I just come back to, I don't understand why the vendors are so secretive about everything, because it seems to me they just invite criticism and suspicion by being so reluctant to share information.
So I'm with you. I do not trust QR codes, and I don't trust, barcodes. Mm-hmm. I don't want that to be the mechanism for any recounts or any auditing.
Right.
Humanize, readable. And I think that's what the American people are asking for. I will say this to the voter registration rules. So we're very proud of the process that we have in Louisiana. We actually, during the presidential election, we started an investigation that one of our local registrars asked us to start. She was concerned that this individual was changing people's registrations or coercing people to change their registrations. And so she started checking it out. And when you have 17 people registered to vote at a vacant lot, that's a problem. And we make sure our investigations don't impede the election or interfere in the election process. But it became so voluminous that we ended up actually teaming up, asking the Attorney General and his investigators to team up with us and jointly investigate this. And so shortly after January 1st, we had enough evidence to have this gentleman arrested. He was a candidate for office, and it was in a councilmanic district. And so he was moving people in. He won only 19 votes, but he had re-registered a ton of people. I don't even know what the final number was. So the Attorney General has arrest powers. I do not. And so we stepped out. We did a press conference announcing the arrest had been made and charges being brought by the district attorney. And the individual pled guilty and had to resign from office and can't serve for 5 years minimum.
Well, that's really important, because it shows that an alert local official,
that's right,
tells you gather information, you have that's the thing that I think is missing all over the place, is that most officials will not investigate. And it so disturbs the public when they see people doing these things and nothing happens. So kudos to you and the Attorney General and the whole continuum.
Well, it goes back to your election code, and our election code doesn't allow for anyone to bring in more than 10 voter registration applications at a time. And when the registrar noticed he was bringing in batches of 10 at a time, she's like, okay, he's subverting the law. So she said, okay, you've got to start signing the back of these applications so that we know you're bringing them in. And he did. He didn't have to, but she convinced him he had to. So that's how we were able to then track. And she drove out to these sites and she said, there's no way, And so I was really pleased with her actions. We teach and train our local election officials to be on alert. They are appointed officials, so they don't want to break the law and have issues, on them, because they also deal with all the early voting and and absentee ballots themselves. So they're on the line too, and so I really appreciate their extra attention to the details, because that's so very important. And then we do checks, census checks, to make sure that our rolls aren't inflated. Most people don't realize that. And so it's, you know, you just got to have, over time, you've got to keep adding and adjusting your election code to provide for these types of things. And that's real important. And we avoided the Georgia, the whole Georgia situation, as you well know, and others. But I know Georgia is in the spotlight right now.
Again,
because of 2000 Mules movie by Dinesh D'Souza. We passed the law early on, and I couldn't believe it, but it was prior to everything breaking and really going nuts over COVID and everything. The governor signed it into law. And that is, we outlawed absentee ballot request harvesting, absentee ballot harvesting. And we did it by, we said, if you're a 501c3, because we know that these not-for-profits aren't really nonpartisan.
That's true.
501c3s, 501c4s, political action committees, political campaigns, political parties, none of them can harvest any of them. And if any individual is turning in a ballot that's not for a family member, you have to, you can only do one, and you have to fill out a form identifying yourself. You have to provide your ID and the reason, the relationship to that person. And if you bring in family members or multiple family members, then you have to also sign it and identify your relationship to those individuals. And I myself have filled out the form because I brought my mother and father's ballots in because they weren't going to make it through the postal service. It's a system that works. It's a paper trail to follow the people mm-hmm. who are trying to probably some cases manipulate the system. And in some cases not manipulate the system, but at least it gives a level of integrity and confidence to the people that we're doing everything we can to make sure that there's no manipulation, on the grassroots level of people's ballots.
Well, boy, that is so important. I wish Pennsylvania would go back to the law they had before the legislature, the Republican legislature, passed this Act 77 that just upended their process. And it's a complete mess there. But that's a good example of what not to do. And you're a good example of what to do. But you mentioned the voter rolls, and I wanted to turn to, there are a lot of people across the country, grassroots citizens, who have become aware of and concerned about an organization called ERIC, election registration
information
center or something like that. And it was funded initially by George Soros, started by a guy named David Becker, who's a real lefty and has founded an organization, the Center for Election Information and Innovation, Election Innovation
and Research.
And Research, CEIR. And you have been the first Secretary of State across the country who's spoken up and said, you know, some of the concerns that citizens have raised about ERIC have gotten your attention, and you're going to put a pause on Louisiana's continued participation. Can you explain what ERIC is and what it does and what your concerns are? Because I think you've been a real leader in this as well.
Well, ERIC is supposed to help states maintain their registration, voter registration lists. It is a multi-state, I think it's now up to 31, it may be 32 states, where we exchange data through a third party, through ERIC, and it's supposed to be anonymized information to see if there's any duplicate registrations, whether it's through motor vehicles or Social Security Death Index or what have you. And so it creates multiple reports for states to act on. There was one other part of it that is at first was communicated to us before we joined as, you know, the medium between. So we're dealing with voter registration lists and updates, which is a conservative issue, and then voter registration, which is, from their terminology, considered a Democratic issue or a liberal. Right. And I'm like, well, you know, we register people. Our locals register people. I mean, we don't deny people registration unless it's an invalid registration for whatever reason. But anyway, So voter registration list maintenance was very important to us and is important to most Republican secretaries, if not all. It should be important to all secretaries of state nationwide. But anyway, so we were sold on that. Well, but the kicker is that you have to do a mailing to non-registered voters every other year. And that's mandatory.
ERIC or by NVRA?
By ERIC. But your voter registration list maintenance is not mandatory.
Right.
But it's mandatory, it's not mandatory in ERIC, but it's mandatory through the NVRA.
Right. The National Voter Registration Act, federal law. Right. Yeah, you're supposed to maintain the voter rolls.
Absolutely. And so if some states aren't maintaining them, well, big question mark, why? Why isn't that mandatory if registering new voters is mandatory? So when the concerns initially came up post 2020, you know, that kind of jumped back out in my head. And I said, you know, we really need to look into this. I want a full investigation. I want to know who's involved. I want to know how the information is exchanged. I want to know how the reports are driven. And also the other kicker is that the information in the reports that ERIC generates are considered confidential.
Right.
But I can't go public with it because it comes through a report for them. And my question to ERIC was, why can't I report potentially fraudulent registrations on my web page when it's my data?
They're registered in your state.
Right. You can post your data, but you can't post anything that comes off of our report. So I'm like, well, then you're telling me I can't post the data is what you're telling me. Well, not exactly. I'm like, okay.
Yes, you are.
You are. And so then I started asking questions about, so now we as election officials are being asked constantly, how are you auditing? What audit processes do you have? You know, how can you improve your audit processes, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, so what is the audit process for the entities that are dealing with sensitive data for state voters? And they said, oh, well, each company does a self-report. I said, okay, so you're telling me you can't report to me through an independent audit that no one has accessed the hardware, where the data has been stored or where the hashing has occurred in technical terms.
Those are processes that ERIC performs.
Right.
And they won't give you information about the security and the audits, auditing the security of those systems.
They tell me what they can tell me the processes that the entities go through, but there's no independent audit saying
to make sure it's true.
They followed those. Yes.
So what did you do with regard to your concern? What did they say when you asked for all this information?
Well, they did a conference call. They asked us, of course, they provided me additional information, but they asked me to keep it confidential because the membership agreement requires it and other states are involved and blah, 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 blah. And I said, okay, I at least want to see the data and I want my IT team to examine it. My IT team didn't see anything that brought any real concerns, but again, we're not getting into the nitty gritty of where the data is stored, who had access to the data, was there any attacks on that data center or that hard drive, and did any IP address that didn't have permission to be there, were they there? And, you know, I sort of almost began feeling like the citizens who are concerned about each state's voting system. I'm asking for information I can't give myself in terms, but I can talk about the process and I have to publicly discuss it with the legislature. So I've got a level of transparency that I can give to the people of Louisiana, but there's really no level of transparency that I can get from a group that I'm paying money to to get.
Well, and that you're paying the taxpayers. It's tax dollars. All these states are paying money to Eric. And I read the membership agreement, and there were several things in there that just popped out at me. One you referenced is that they have these strict rules about what you can and cannot do, that you mainly what you can't do with data that a state gets from Eric. But there are no restrictions on what Eric can do with the data that it gets from the states. And that to me is such a big red flag. And the fact that it also requires this confidentiality of records that the National Voter Registration Act says are public records. List maintenance records are public under the federal law.
Yeah.
But they say, no, you can't share any of that. The other thing I don't get, one of the things that I've been really struck by, and you made reference to it, but when we talk about list maintenance and cleaning voter rolls, which is something conservatives care about, and which lots of citizens over the last year and a half have been studying voter rolls in their states and localities, and they've found big mess everywhere. I don't know about Louisiana. I haven't had anybody tell me that about Louisiana, so we'll exclude Louisiana. But when you look at the left, it's almost Orwellian. They talk about, Eric is supposed to be committed to list maintenance, but the only requirement, as you say, is to register voters. And there's no requirement of any member to clean its voter rolls. And I noticed in the NAS resolution that was adopted a couple of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, NAS calls on federal government to assist with list maintenance. And you read the resolution, and it says nothing about list maintenance. It calls on all these federal agencies to turn over lists of people who may not be registered so that they can get them registered. It doesn't say the Department of Homeland Security should quit charging states for the database of the non-citizens. It doesn't say the Social Security Administration should give the states for free on a regular basis the list of people who've died. Now, that's the kind of thing. And so it's just the language, when they talk about list maintenance, they're talking about registering more voters and dumping more voters from, names of various government lists, which is their ideal, is just to dump everybody into this big pot of a. They don't really like voter registration, so they figure the more chaotic it is, the better, I guess. But anyway, I just thought that was so interesting. And I know David Becker attacked you publicly for asking these questions. And I just think that, you're a real hero to a lot of people, whether you realize it or not, for asking the questions.
Well, hero status is, as I tell some of the folks in Louisiana that I work with regularly, hero status is not important to me. Doing the right thing is important to me, and being able to stand up and be proud of our elections and turning over every possible stone of any questionable activity is the job that is before me. And when you're involved in a multi-state compact trying to create a level of integrity, and you start asking questions, and then all of a sudden out of state newspapers start calling me gullible. I'm thrown. I'm like, how do they even know my name? I mean, it's like, give me a break. I mean, there's something else going on here. I mean, that just raised my red flag even higher. And it's like, okay, well now I need to ask even more questions because quite frankly, you wouldn't be pushing back if there wasn't something there or somebody's engaging you to push back. And so somebody doesn't want me to see something. And so, I know honest pushback, and then I know PR pushback. And there was a PR effort to push back on me and make me look like the outsider, when in fact, I think I've raised a significant issue to the level that, just like with the MSPs, I mean, nobody even paid attention to MSPs. I mean, I don't mind stepping out there. I don't mind asking questions. And if I'm wrong, prove me wrong.
No, that's how I feel about that.
I'm really not trying to assert I'm not trying to assert that there's, you know, absolutely something nefarious going on. What I'm asking is, how are you protecting the data of the people that I represent, that I've been sworn to protect? And if there are reports out there and there's suspicion out there, then all I'm asking you to do is show me how nothing nefarious is occurring, and I'll back off. Or two, what I've actually discovered is there's not enough security in the process. Mm-hmm. A self-report is nothing to me. That's like, okay, honor system in school. You go ahead and take your test, give yourself a grade, and let me know how it turned out. That's not how it works. It's just not how it works.
Not how it's supposed to work. Well, we could talk a long time about all these things. I just wanted to introduce you to people who really care about elections, and because you're doing such great things and you're leading the charge on a lot of different issues. And mainly what you've done is you've shown that an election official who stands up and says, I'm for transparency, and people asking me questions, I'll do my best to answer them and you've gone on and asked the questions that nobody else has asked. And I'm not sure they're given the great answers, but at least we have somebody who's asking the questions, and we'll keep after it and give you support. I want people to give you support for what you're doing. So we appreciate all of your time. We appreciate all of your effort. And we thank you for spending a little time with us today to talk about Louisiana, setting the pace for the rest of the country.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Cleta. I've enjoyed it as well.
Thank you. And that concludes this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. We're very grateful that Secretary of State Kyle Ardoin from Louisiana, who also serves as the national president of the National Association of Secretaries of State, he's an election leader, election integrity leader that we can all be proud of. So we urge you to share this episode with your friends, subscribe to Who's Counting, visit our website, find out about the resources for citizen engagement in the election process. And with that, we would say goodbye, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth, because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, and to become part of the Election Integrity Network.